Your North Carolina Reading Service presents this program for our blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week, read by John Fetterson. Our issue dated November 24th of 2021. And for our musicians today, who mysteriously beamed right into our studio complex today, they style themselves Zargon the Obliterator and the Fleet of Terror. You may not have heard of them, but let's just say that the asteroid belt out in the solar system wasn't always an asteroid belt. It was a nice little planet until Zargon did a gig out there some while ago. So I guess I'd better get reading our issue today of the Indie Week. And I'll begin with an article by John Byrne called Right Wing Town Square. Last Friday, Cristiano Ronaldo's Facebook page had the most interactions in the world. "Let's chase what we're trying to achieve this season," he exclaimed. The Portuguese soccer star's post, however, was an island in a partisan sea. The next six most engaged posts came from outspoken American conservatives cheering the acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse for the murder of two men at a Wisconsin protest. Looking at shared links, conservatives' Facebook dominance was even more stark. 18 of the top 20 most engaged page links in the world originated from conservative Facebook pages. Facebook's largest leak in history focused on the company's past. Missing, however, from the coverage of a Facebook whistleblower has been a focus on the present. To look at Facebook's data about user interactions, which reflect the engagement of its users with content worldwide, is to find oneself in a universe where American conservative voices dominate. While Facebook claims to host a diverse spectrum of 2 billion users, its daily engagement ranking exposes how right-wing actors eclipse all other media conversations atop its algorithm. 3 hours after 18-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted of the murder of two men, Facebook lit up with a panoply of conservative pages cheering the teen's exoneration. Even a cursory glance at the scoreboard, the top 20 most engaged link shares by pages in the world, suggests that Facebook has become a town square for right-wing American voices. 90% of Facebook's most engaged pages linking out to other websites were conservative pages, with just 2 mainstream sources, NPR and NBC News, eking out a place on the list. 24 hours after the verdict, conservative pages gave up some ground. But while link posts from Myanmar, Great Britain, and Qatar joined the list, conservative American pages still held 15 of the top 20 posts and 90% of the top 10 worldwide. Even though Facebook banned former President Donald Trump after the January 6th riot at the Capitol, a Donald Trump for President page beat out all mainstream news outlets twice in the 3 hours after the verdict. NPR and NBC came in at 14 and 17, behind Donald Trump for President at positions 7 and 8. One Trump for President post read, "Kyle should spend the next year suing the absolute pants off every news outlet that defamed him." There's no indication former President Trump is involved with that page. Also trumping NPR and NBC 3 different times was Dan Bongino, a 3-time failed congressional candidate, former police officer, and Secret Service agent who is now a conservative radio host. Bongino had also captured 5 of the top 10 most engaged slots the prior day. Facebook reveals daily user engagement data through CrowdTangle, a tool publishers use to get insight into what's trending. For the past several years, New York Times reporter Kevin Roos has tweeted, "Facebook's top 10, which is a daily list of pages atop that engagement algorithm." Roos's list reveals how often conservative pages win in Facebook's interaction metrics. Facebook has repeatedly said engagement data does not reflect how often content appears in users' news feeds. In August, Facebook released a report showing that recipes and cute animals ranked among the most viewed items on the platform. The report was undermined by the New York Times, which revealed the company had shelved an earlier analysis showing the most viewed link was, quote, a news article with a headline suggesting that the coronavirus vaccine was at fault for the death of a Florida doctor. Facebook then released the earlier report. Facebook's third quarter report appeared to support the company's claims that the most viewed content is not partisan. The most widely viewed domains included YouTube, GoFundMe, and Amazon. And the most popular posts were memes. Only the anti-China page, Epoch Times, which spreads right-wing conspiracy theories, stood out among the top 20 most seen U.S. pages. A former Facebook executive who spoke to Raw Story criticized the company's transparency reports. That executive noted that Facebook had only released a tiny amount of data. The reports only show the top 20 in any category. Better reporting, that executive said, would include not simply what was popular, but where, including different geographic areas of the United States. Facebook should also reveal what content gets distributed to which demographics, he said, as well as more current data to allow analysis of trends and pockets of trends on Facebook. Facebook's most engaged link shared by a page after the acquittal was posted by Bongino, the conservative talk show host. Bongino's Facebook post linked to a video where a crowd outside the courthouse cheered to a chant of freedom wins, followed by another man screaming, Second Amendment stays. Bongino has more monthly Facebook engagement than the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN combined. Asked why he's so popular on Facebook, he said, I think people just love the message. Bongino has promoted conspiracy theories, including allegations that Democrats spied on former President Trump's 2016 campaign and falsely asserted that masks are, quote, largely ineffective at preventing the spread of COVID-19. Facebook's second and third most engaged post came after the Rittenhouse verdict came from Ben Shapiro, founder of the conservative news site The Daily Wire. His page wrote, Not guilty was the correct verdict. Anyone with a prefrontal cortex who has watched the trial for more than 30 seconds knew this. Anyone who says differently is a lying hack. Justice was served, his page added in another post. The left accepting the verdict in a peaceable manner remains the sizable elephant in the room. The Daily Wire article linked asserted that social media was celebrating the not guilty verdict, which was true, at least on Facebook. Conservative radio host Buck Sexton, the author, wrote, Joe Biden, CNN, MSNBC, and the Democratic establishment should apologize for lying about Rittenhouse as a racist and school shooter and white supremacist for months. But they won't, because they have no honor and don't care about the destruction they constantly incite. These jurors are patriots, Sexton continued. They chose honor, truth, and love of country over the whims of the vicious leftist mob. The Daily Wire's article was the most engaged news article linked from a Facebook page in the 3 hours following the verdict. The Daily Wire's success is linked to the fact that the company controls multiple Facebook pages. At least eight have more than 500,000 followers, including Daily Wire, The Angry Patriot, Fed Up Americans, The Real Patriots, Matt Walsh, and Donald Trump Is My President. It also controls pages with more than 100,000 followers. Conservative News, The Conservative, Boycott, The Right News, Restless Patriot, Pro-America News, and The United Patriots. Shapiro's own page, with 8 million followers, is run by The Daily Wire, which describes itself as one of America's fastest-growing conservative media companies and counter-cultural outlets for news, opinion, and entertainment. The site is owned by Shapiro, his editorial partners, and self-made fracking billionaires. The Daily Wire was forced to acknowledge ownership of its other pages after an exposé by Popular Information. Facebook acknowledged the pages engaged in deceptive coordinated sharing that violated its rules but allowed them to continue to operate. During the Trump administration, Shapiro was among a number of conservatives who had private dinners with Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg. While Facebook correctly notes that engagement and views are different, data CrowdTangle releases about videos reveals total views. That data shows the conservatives won that race as well. 8 of the 10 most popular videos posted about that trial in the first 3 hours were posted by conservative pages. Those pages' videos received 87% of views. A liberal political page, Occupy Democrats, captured 13%. Occupy Democrats had the 8th and 9th most popular videos about the trial. 18 of the top 20 videos, or 90%, related to the trial by engagement were posted by conservative pages. Twitter's algorithmic response to the verdict was more balanced. 5 hours after that verdict, Rittenhouse and Kenosha ranked as number 1 and 2 most trending topics. Not guilty was celebrated among some of the tweets, but Twitter's number 5 topic referenced Representative Jerry Nadler, Democrat of New York, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, who said Rittenhouse's acquittal was, quote, a miscarriage of justice. On Twitter, Black Lives Matter landed in 8th. On Facebook, Black Lives Matter or any page affiliated with Black Empowerment didn't appear anywhere in the top 100 most engaged public page posts. And as I may have mentioned there, this article originally appeared on Raw Story. More locally now, Tomasi McDonald's column from Durham, A Bloody Weekend. The weekend before last, Steve Chalmers, the Bull City's police chief from 2003 to 2007, helped organize a ceasefire with activities taking place Saturday morning at Old Hillside Park. It was part of a community group effort in several Durham neighborhoods to kick off a day of peace at the tail end of one of the city's deadliest years on record. Late at night the Friday before, gunfire erupted near a railroad crossing in the eastern part of town, killing a teen and wounding two other people. By early Sunday morning, police had reported another fatal shooting of a 24-year-old man in North Durham. But in between, on a sunny late morning Saturday, Hillside Park was buzzing with activity. A disc jockey served up old-school rhythm and blues music underneath a picnic shelter. Several food trucks in the parking lot served tacos and fish. A couple of teens tossed a Nerf football while smaller kids jumped up and down inside a bounce house or romped in and around the playground in the middle of the park. A group of young men hung out along the park fringes. Chalmers was one of a cadre of a current and former elected officials, including former city council member Jackie Wagstaff, current member Didriana Freeman, and Durham County Commission Chair Brenda Howerton. The ceasefire was part of a violence prevention project that began 2 years ago when Chalmers, Durham County District Court Judge Pat Evans, and Harold Chestnut, a member of Partners Against Crime, PAC, a city-supported, community-based volunteer organization, came together to create a new partnership, New Durham Vision. That's collaborating with NC Central University professor Henry McCoy's Haiti Reborn project. The group started a dialogue with individuals who are involved in gangs and gang activity to find out what's going on and what we could do to reduce the activity, Chalmers told the Indy. A series of intervention strategies, including jobs, housing, education, and health care opportunities, followed. Chalmers describes that project as one-stop shop, an ecosystem designed to reduce violent crime. The initiative focuses on older gang members who have rank in the organization's hierarchies. Chalmers explains they came up with the name New Durham Vision. Chalmers says Mayor-elect Elaine O'Neill has spoken with the group, too, and affirmed addressing gun violence as one of her top priorities when she takes office next month. Chalmers said O'Neill contacted me after she announced she was running and said she felt good about her chances. She said the first thing she wanted to do is address violent crime. In recent months, Durham leaders have pointed to local gun violence as part of a national trend that the COVID pandemic has exacerbated. With the rise in violent crime, calls nationally and locally for more police have nearly drowned out demands to defund the police following George Floyd's murder last year. By this time in 2020, Durham police had reported a new dismal tally of 882 shootings, 291 people struck by gunfire, and a year-long total of 37 homicides. But police say this year has been the worst on record for homicides in the Bull City, worse even than bloody 2016, which saw a total of 42. With a little over a month left in 2021, 43 people have already lost their lives to violence, including that child killed two Fridays ago in East Durham. During this month's ceasefire, police detectives searched for evidence in the 1,000 block of Drew Street. Neighbors reported hearing multiple gunshots overnight that had killed the child and wounded two others. Investigators used yellow caution tape to cordon off the shooting scene near the intersection of Drew and Granby Streets. A police patrol car was parked in front of the crime scene tape. A police mobile command center was parked just beyond the railroad tracks in that working-class neighborhood. Lieutenant Jackie Werner said it was about 11:18 p.m. Friday when police arrived in response to reports of gunfire. The officers found two people, both wounded of gunshots, inside a vehicle. Paramedics rushed one of the victims to the hospital with life-threatening injuries and pronounced the other victim, the child whose name hasn't really been released yet, dead at the scene. Police found another man nearby who had been seriously wounded, Werner said in a press release. He, too, was rushed to the hospital with life-threatening injuries. While detectives scour the area for clues, a young couple who had moved into the neighborhood 4 months earlier worked in their modest yard. She mowed the grass. He used a weed eater to clear the high weeds that encircled a tree stump. The couple, who declined to give their names, said they were in bed when they heard gunshots on Drew Street behind their home at 11:30-ish. The young man answered when asked how many shots he had heard. He said 10 or so. Other people in the neighborhood told area news outlets they heard as many as 20 to 30 gunshots and that officers put down more than 20 evidence markers along Drew Street during their investigation. Isn't it unusual in this? Is it unusual in this exact location? Yes. But far away? No, said the woman mowing her grass when asked if gunfire was a usual occurrence in the neighborhood. During a Hillside High School performance run that began on Friday night and ended with a Sunday afternoon matinee, the performances featured a massive 80-foot-long, 5-foot-wide quilt that lists the names of 910 people who have been murdered in the Bull City since 1994. The quilt was on display in the lobby of the Gettys Tab Theater. Sidney Brody, an artist, musician, and writer who grew up in Durham, created that Durham Homicide Memorial quilt. Brody said the fatal shooting of 2-year-old Shaquana Atwater in the old Few Gardens public housing complex back in 1994 inspired the quilt. Brody was working as a 9/11 communications officer at the time, and he told the Indy, "The first 100 or so squares were actually sewn on in 1996. This work documents all murders in the city or county of Durham, regardless of race, method, or weapon used. Occasionally, it's pointed out that I may have missed a name. Once the name of the person is confirmed, it's added as an out-of-sequence status." On Saturday evening, Durham County Sheriff Clarence Burkhead spoke before students in Hillside High School's drama department, and theater director Wendell Tabb staged State of Urgency, a moving, riveting play about social justice issues in Durham and across the country. Prior to Burkhead's short speech, a group of Durham parents who have lost their children to gun violence also spoke to the audience. Tabb, a Tony Award-winning educator, told the audience that he wrote the play and then asked his students to submit topics and opinions that were important to them. And he said, "Listen to their dialogue carefully, because it's young people speaking to you. During the civil rights movement, it was the voices of the young people wanting change. More than 40 young people offered poetry, stories, monologues, songs, and dances, all augmented by music and a collage of videos to share how violence has shaped their lives and world views. Photos of some of the city's homicide victims appeared on the stage's triplex of screens. The Hillside students spoke of a world unknown to them in the late 1970s, decades before they were born, when neighborhoods were truly neighborly, where their grandparents could leave their doors unlocked and the children, who became their parents, could safely play outside. They recalled music that served as a soundtrack for the period that was life-affirming and in which people cared for one another. They asked, "What happened? What happened to our village?" The music grew dark, discordant, and uneven. How did the neighborhoods where their families grew up become hoods? And urban alienation become a reality? The answers lie with a crack cocaine epidemic, unprecedented gun violence, an AIDS crisis, and an ill-fated tough-on-crime bill that led to the mass incarceration of black people, along with the wholesale loss of good-paying, blue-collar manufacturing jobs that went overseas. The students at the historically black high school addressed the internal conflicts of race as a consequence of colorism and genderism, good hair and homelessness, racism and the racial wealth gap, along with Black Lives Matter and police brutality. One performer repeated, "The world needs rehab," several times during the play. Another said, "It's normal to hear gunshots. It's normal to not trust a system that's supposed to protect you. It's normal to see a black person get killed on TV at night." The students shouted, "You won't let us breathe," in unison and frustration. As the play ended, a young actor pulled a handgun out of his waistband and shot dead another man near his home. A second young man, armed with a gun, chased the shooter through the audience and shot him dead in front of his front door. The slain children's mothers came outside and sobbed over their bodies. As approaching sirens blared, the police arrived and unfurled yellow caution tape before beginning their search for evidence. The student performers were enacting what had taken place minutes away on Drew Street the night before. Before the weekend ended, Durham police reported another fatal shooting in the northern part of town, where officers found a 24-year-old man, Kaliak Lashawn Sanford, lying outside an abandoned car. It was just after 1:30 a.m. on the 2300 block of Lednam Street. Sanford was mortally wounded. Paramedics rushed the Durham man to the hospital, where he later died. By the following Wednesday, police had not announced an arrest in the weekend shootings. The homicide quilt went on display Thursday morning in the lobby of the county's Justice Center at 510 South Dillard Street. Toya Chinflu, whose daughter Daphne Lorraine participated in that high school play, said, "If a white police officer kills a black person, the community is outraged, and well, we should. But addressing black-on-black violence is within reach." She said, "We're more empowered to correct the situation in our own community." Our next article, by Jasmine Gallup from Raleigh, writes, "Fidelity, Uncharitable." Tucked at the intersection of Creedmoor Road and Glenwood Avenue sits a nondescript office building. It's squat, tan, and easy to miss, unless you happen to be driving by 2 weeks ago when a group of protesters rallied outside, hoisting signs that read, "Stop funding fascism," and "Lives are at stake." Pardon me. "Lives are at stake." The dozen or so protesters tried to draw attention to the national headquarters of Fidelity Charitable, the largest grant-making organization in the country. When people think of Fidelity, most think of their 401k or investment portfolios, not Klansmen marching through the streets of Charlottesville. But financial records show the company and white supremacy are inextricably linked. From 2015 to 2018, $4.8 million was funneled to hate groups nationwide. through Fidelity Charitable, the philanthropic arm of Fidelity Investments, according to an investigative report by Sludge. In practice, individual donors give money to Fidelity Charitable, which then disperses that money to groups of the donor's choice. Another $2.5 million was given to those groups in 2019 for a total of $7.4 million, according to the most recent IRS tax records available. The 31 organizations to whom some donors sent their money are deemed hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks groups that, quote, demean or debase an entire other group of people based on their inherent characteristics. The SPLC director of the Intelligence Project, Heidi Beirich, told Sludge. That list includes such infamous names as VDare.com, a website that regularly publishes white supremacist and anti-Semitic rhetoric, and the Alliance Defending Freedom, which equates homosexuality with pedophilia and supports the criminalization of sex between LGBTQ people. Isabel Walsh, who helped organize this month's protest, wants to spread the word about where Fidelity Charitable's money is going. She told the Indy, "The idea that this could be happening fairly openly without any accountability is at the heart of this campaign. It's sort of one of those things where you're like, wow, I never thought about that, but now that I have, that's startling." As a member of the Unmasking Fidelity movement, which originated in Boston and now has come to the Triangle, Walsh wants Fidelity Charitable to publicly disclose all past contributions to white supremacist and other hate groups. Local protesters are also demanding Fidelity Charitable redistribute the money to people who are targets of hate groups, as well as develop a screening policy that declares certain groups off limits for donations. Walsh says, "There's such a broad spectrum of places you could donate to, and Fidelity's only requirement is that they're a 501c3, which can cover a lot of territory." Historically, donor-advised funds like Fidelity Charitable are cause-neutral, which means they don't advocate for a specific cause or disallow giving to specific charities. They simply ensure money is going to legal 501c3 organizations. Fidelity Charitable did not respond to IndyWeek's request for comments by our print deadline, but officials have made statements to other news organizations about this policy. Spokesman Stephen Austin told the Chronicle of Philanthropy, "Fidelity Charitable does not make grants to groups that may be involved in illegal activities such as terrorism, money laundering, hate crimes, or fraud." The nonprofit also monitors public records to see if the money is being used for non-charitable purposes. Fidelity Investments Vice President Sophie Launay said in an email to Sludge, quote, "If there are concerning reports identified regarding a specific charity, Fidelity Charitable documents such reports and considers the information in the event a grant is recommended to the charity involved." But Walsh says, "Existing policies and systems are simply not doing enough." She says, "You can't really remain neutral when donors are using a lack of limitations to donate certain ways. If Fidelity Charitable establishes more stringent guidelines around what kind of places you can donate to, that can be a way to redirect funds to places that would be explicitly helpful." Well, here it is. I'm about halfway through my podcast for today, and thanks to a fairly thin news issue, I have plenty of time to read some arts, culture, food, and drink articles, also in from Indie Week. And here I go. Starting with art, preserving the future. Chris Camera wrote this. Sonora Lynch squeezes 10 sheets of wet corn husk between her fingers, 10 strands of black yarn pressed in the middle. She ties the bundle at the top with a piece of string, spreads the husks apart one by one like wings, and folds them up and over. The yarn hangs down from the center. She tells a group of students, "Tie them tight. If you don't tie them tight, it'll all fall apart." Well, it's Tuesday night meeting of the Carolina Indian Circle, UNC's student group for Native students and allies, and Lynch is demonstrating how to make corn shuck dolls. Once everyone has gathered their supplies, Lynch says a prayer in Siouan, the native language of the Haliwa Saponi tribe, asking the Creator to give us everything we need, nothing extra or special. And she tells the students, "You all are warriors. I know how hard it can be to be a native in a place like this. When I went to school, people used to pull my hair and say, 'Oh, you think you're Indian, huh?'" Several of the students are from the same tribe as Ms. Sinora. And for those who aren't, she's still an inspiration. The walkway between the two buildings of the Frank Porter Graham Student Union is an encompassing art plaza called The Gift. It's a central meeting place on campus. Lynch, now 58, designed the expansive mosaic back in 2004. She now lives in Warrenton. She grew up near Hollister, North Carolina. Her mother raised seven children on Mills Road, a gravel drive connecting grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins who all lived and worked together. The family fed themselves by vegetable farming and cultivating and curing tobacco. When gathering corn together, Lynch's mother often told her daughter stories of making dolls out of corn shuck, and when she was 12, Lynch asked her mother how to make them, and says that was one of the first art of crafts, you could say, that I started learning with my hands. Soon after, while everyone else worked and played in the fields, Lynch began going to her grandfather James Mills' home to help him weave baskets and chair bottoms out of split cane, white oak, and elm bark. Mills was one of the original councilmen of the Haliwa Saponi. In the early 1950s, he held the first recorded tribal meeting on his front porch. Before that, tribal meetings were held in secret. Lynch says, and he's referring to the Plecker Law, officially called the Racial Integrity Act of 1924, which made it illegal for anyone to identify themselves on birth or marriage certificates as anything besides white, colored, or mixed. And he said, in North Carolina, you weren't allowed to say you were Indian. Our people would write Indian on their documents, but they were scribbled out and erased. After the Indian Removal Act of 1830, they didn't want any tribes to gather together. You couldn't socialize. You really couldn't dance. People kind of hid away in the woods, and they held on to their native culture by knowing the land and knowing where the water sources were. This went on for over a century. It wasn't until 1965, 2 years after Lynch was born, that the Haliwa Saponi received official tribal recognition from North Carolina. The tribe reclaimed their fishing and hunting rights. People started dancing and dressing in our regalias again. In the years that Lynch helped her grandfather weave, she also learned to do beadwork and make pottery, saying, "I was one of those children that just always picked up on doing things with my hands." In high school, she began to sketch and draw and excelled in art classes. She says, all the native students got picked on. Teachers were disrespectful to our culture, our histories. One day, her history teacher told the entire class, any student absent tomorrow is going to get an E. That's a failing grade. This was no accident. The next day was Powwow Friday, a ceremonial day that most native students planned to attend. Hearing the teacher's threat to fail students out of the class for missing one day, Sonora stood up and said, give me an E. Years after she graduated, Lynch started teaching fellow natives around North Carolina, passing down the skills of beadwork, basket weaving, doll making, and pottery that she had learned from her family and tribe. Emily Grant was the Youth and Families Program Coordinator for 30 years at the North Carolina Museum of History. In 1992, Grant was new to her job, looking for programming that highlighted communities specific to North Carolina. Someone told her what a marvelous beadworker Lynch was, so Grant reached out to see if Lynch would do a public demonstration and teach people about Haliwa Saponi culture. Well, that was Lynch's first time teaching outside of native circles or being inside a museum. All weekend, Sonora sat at a booth in the main hallway with her daughter Kwa, then a toddler, playing at her feet. Visitors sat at her table, watched her work, and asked her questions as she worked on a black velvet purse, stringing a dogwood pattern with pink, red, and white beads. The dogwood flower is iconic to the Haliwasaponi tribe, whose annual powwow is called the Blooming of the Dogwood. The flower is a central image in her work, along with turtles, which represent the earth. Many tribes refer to the Americas as Turtle Island. Shortly after the beadwork demonstration, Grant found out about her pottery, and Lynch began teaching clay working classes at the museum. More teaching gigs followed, and her reach across North Carolina grew. Nowadays, Lynch has run a circuit through schools across the state for over two decades, leaving a trail of turtles in her wake. Grant says the images that she uses, the turtle, the dogwood and pine, and all those symbols that you find in nature where her people are from in North Carolina, it's just so familiar and recognizable, and yet you know it's Sonora's when you see it. By 1996, word about Sonora Lynch's pottery made it to the Smithsonian. The Institute featured some of her pieces at the Olympic Games in Atlanta. Her clay piece, Grandmother's Slippers, is still on display at the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. In 2004, UNC Chapel Hill renovated the Student Union. Administrators wanted a part of the building to represent indigenous people, so they brought Lynch to the construction site. Looking down at the big hole in the ground, an image flashed through her mind of a patterned walkway between the two buildings. Back home, she sketched out the design on graph paper, the same way she plans her beadwork. But instead of beads, she imagined bricks, white, red, and brown. The swirling lines of white bricks alongside the walkway represent water. Rounder, undulating lines along one of the buildings represent the hills of North Carolina, a reminder that the earth will supply you with everything you need. In the middle, giant turtles swim with dogwood flowers on their backs. In the very center, the eagle shield grants the gift of protection to all students. Arrows shoot out from the center, signifying direction and a determination to, quote, guide you along your path through life. At the west end of the mosaic, an ear of corn represents the gift of abundance, while at the east end, the medicine wheel signifies the gift of unity among all people. Though the symbols come from Haliwasaponi tradition, the gift was designed to be inclusive to everyone, Lynch says. If people understand what the designs mean, then they'll know that they're part of it, no matter where they come from, no matter who you are. Corn may not have been in your cultural diet, but when we see that, it represents the seed. It symbolizes the future. It symbolizes preserving and preparing and being ready. Then you can understand how that corn relates to you. Back at the Tuesday night meeting of the Carolina Indian Circle, students have been ripping, folding, weaving, and tying the corn shucks for an hour. The bundles begin to take the shapes of people. Students slip buckeyes into the heads for good luck and fashion skirts and other clothes around the torsos. Everyone poses for a group photo with their dolls. Grant said of Lynch, "She walks in beauty wherever she goes. I don't know anyone who doesn't feel better after being in her presence." We'll have a movie review now by Lee Taus, who gives this movie Julia 3.5 stars, and it's now streaming. This is a new documentary about Julia Child. Who hasn't heard about her? Julia Child didn't need much to capture the appetite of audiences on television in the 1960s. Just a hot plate, a frying pan, and a few eggs. The cameras rolled, and she cooked. The simplicity is what made the show work. Likewise, a new documentary highlighting the life of the trailblazing chef didn't need much to tell her story. Julia paints a warm, intimate portrait of the renowned chef using footage of Child from her decades on television, her letters, and interviews. It's refreshing in its straightforwardness and no-frills approach, placing Child firmly as the catalyst of a sea change in American cooking. Before Child hit the small screen, American cuisine had hit what was possibly an all-time low. Microwaved meals and colorful Jell-O salads. It wasn't until Child found herself living in post-war France that she was introduced to real cooking, sizzled and drizzled in butter, fat balanced with flavor and spice. It ignited her soul and became her calling. Cooking wasn't Child's first love. That was her husband, Paul, whom she met in 1944 during World War II. At 6'2", Child had been too tall to enlist in the army, so she hoped instead to be an intelligence officer, thinking her height would serve as a sort of a disguise. While stationed at the Office of Strategic Services in Kandy, she met Paul and married him 2 years later. After the war, Child enrolled in the famous Le Cordon Bleu cooking school. At the time, cooking as a profession was dominated by men. It was less of a pastime than perfunctory. Women did the prep work, but men ruled the kitchen. Part of Child's charm was her air of obliviousness to such boundaries, which is why, perhaps, she found it so easy to overstep them. She walked into a cooking classroom full of men hungry to learn. She didn't hold herself back, and no one else did either. For Child, cooking was an act of self-love she could share, and television provided the perfect medium. Like female chefs, cooking shows simply didn't exist. As if naive to this fact, when scheduled to appear on an educational program to discuss her best-selling cookbook, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Child requested a hot plate. With her style and humble narration, Child whipped up an omelet on screen, captivating audiences and spawning a genre that would be endlessly replicated. The success of Julia is that filmmakers Julie Cohen and Betsy West, that Oscar-winning duo behind RBG and My Name is Pauli Murray, realized Child's story didn't need much dressing to shine. The approach was refreshing and reminded me of the types of documentaries I grew up with. Found footage and simple narration without CGI montages and cheesy reenactments. The film is loving and kind, much like its subject, and educates as much as it endears. In cooking, as in film, sometimes less is more. All right, let's move to food and drink again with a column by Eric Ginsberg called Grapes of Craft. Opening a new business is an inherently stressful pursuit requiring a level of determination, faith, and chutzpah. Lashonda Modest is an entrepreneur at heart and is no stranger to that pursuit. Before opening Melanated Wine in August, she'd run several businesses in the past, ranging from a commercial cleaning company to a jewelry store. Modest told Indie Week, while perched on a stool in her strip mall storefront at the intersection of MLK Parkway and Fayetteville Street, "The hardest part has been the lack of financial resources for a business in this industry." And that financial barrier is higher and comes with its own unique hurdles if it's an alcohol-related business. And she says, before you can even apply for an ABC license with the state of North Carolina, you have to have a facility. And that's before you even know you're getting approved to do anything in alcohol. When you're doing commercial retail facilities, they want you to sign a 2 to 3 year lease. So it's like I'm on the hook for something I'm not certain I'm going to get approved for. Luckily, Modest managed to find a space, a mid-sized spot with a compact store area at the front, and a larger rectangular tasting room area stretching back from the parking lot. The industry lane unit used to be occupied by former NBA All-Star Stephon Marbury's shoe company, and is almost in view of Greybeard Distillery, maker of Bedlam Vodka. Once her paperwork was in order, Modest quietly launched Melanated Wine. She already needs a bigger space, she says. We're only 3 months in, and we've outgrown it. We really want a space with this ambience, but three times bigger. Melanated Wines' rapid success can be attributed to the company's four quality wines and their affordability. They range from a $16 fruity white sangria made with mango to a $19 red blend made with Cabernet Franc and Syrah grapes aged in oak barrel. The fruit-forward but eminently drinkable Riesling and floral white blend relying on unoaked Chardonnay fall in the middle of the price range. All four wines are intentionally approachable crowd-pleasers. While three have screw tops, they're the kind of easy riding experience where two friends will be inclined to polish off the bottle. The company's popularity extends beyond the wine itself, though. It's also tied to its founder and its intentional naming. She says, "We wanted to be very explicit and have people know it was a black-owned brand. Everyone likes drinking wine, but why should you buy from me? We wanted to bring something that was by us into the industry. What we really wanted to bring to the industry was our culture. We wanted people to know we're on an even playing field." She hopes that her visibility will motivate more women of color to join the wine industry or open their own businesses. And she said several people have already reached out to her about following suit. She says, "I do hope it sparks an interest. People are actually seeing me and being motivated. Even if it was a seed that was planted a while ago, they see that it's attainable." While there are several prominent national black-owned wine businesses, such as Longevity Wines and Maison Noire Wines, black wine professionals reportedly make up just 2% of the industry, and ownership stats are even lower. Most black-owned wine brands aren't readily identifiable as such to casual consumers, save for a few possible examples like the McBride Sisters Black Girl Magic series. But Modest wanted consumers to know what they are buying and feel an instant connection. She says, "We tell people our wine is culture in a bottle. I don't see that in a store. I don't see anything I can directly relate to or feel a connection with." Touted as Durham's first and only black-owned winery, Melanated Wine is actually one of the lone black-owned wine businesses in the entire state. There are others, of course, such as Seven Springs Farm and Vineyard in Norlina, close to Virginia, up I-85, and Davidson Wine Company, outside of Charlotte. The Association of African American Vintners, of which Modest is a member, doesn't explicitly list any other black wine professionals in North Carolina besides Modest and Davidson wine owner Lindsay Williams. Some members don't have a location provided. Modest's product and branding have helped her stand out, as has the openness of North Carolina's wine industry. She doesn't have a background in wine, but describes herself as a voracious learner who has always been fascinated by wine, adding that part of what attracts her to the industry is the fact there's always more to learn. She's been planning this business for several years and says that everyone she's met in the state has embraced her and offered assistance navigating various challenges, saying, "It really feels like a family, and I love it. North Carolina has just been amazing." All the grapes from Melanated Wine are grown in North Carolina's famed Yadkin Valley wine region, and Modest works directly with their winemakers to bring forward the exact tastes and final products she's looking for. For now, production and bottling are handled externally, vinted and bottled by Powerhouse Childress Vineyards in Lexington. But as the business grows, Modest wants to bring the winemaking process in-house, giving Triangle residents an opportunity to witness the process without traveling out of town. Until then, she's trying to keep up with demand and encouraging locals to come in for a tasting, either by reserving a spot in one of Melanated Wine's regular tastings or by reserving the intimate space for a private event. She says, "I am so confident in the wines we have that when you come in here for a tasting, you're going to walk out buying something." She notes that the space has already been in demand for events like bachelorette parties, birthdays, and other private events. "We really wanted to create an experience for people," she says. This makes sense. melanated mind may be nondescript and unassuming from the outside, but behind a curtain separating the storefront, the tasting room is decked out with an artificial green wall flanked by a branded step and repeat that begs for selfies and tipsy group photos. Between tastings, Modest's small team is constantly fulfilling online orders that have been pouring in from around the country. The crisp and semi-sweet Riesling and Red Blend, which is a well-rounded, medium-bodied wine with minimal tannins, are the top sellers online. But when people try the four wines in person, the white sangria tends to be more popular, Modest says. For now, direct orders in store or online are the only ways to buy a bottle. And local support has been strong, which makes sense considering the Bull City has been home to Modest and her husband since they moved from Illinois a decade ago to provide a better future for their kids. She says, "The history and the culture and the richness of Durham, we love it. We knew Durham was the place for this." Well, my last article in the print version of Indie Week is by Sarah Edwards, and it's called Mushroom Stalking. I guess this time, because it's so close to Thanksgiving, that so many food articles are coming up. But it looks worthwhile reading, so here we go. On a recent foggy Friday afternoon, Frank Hyman is searching for mushrooms in Duke Park. It's a hit-or-miss foraging day, but near the tennis courts, he squats to look at the base of a tree where a spiny cluster of orange mushrooms, they look like the Pam's Labyrinth hand dipped in Cheeto dust, grows. To a novice, the cluster looks something like the popular edible mushroom variety chanterelles, but looks can be deceiving. These, he says, are jack-o'-lanterns. And goes on, when it's that dark, these things will glow, and that is trippy and amazing. But they will also make you sick as a dog for a couple of days. Hyman, age 60, is here to make sure that those hunting for mushrooms do not get sick as a dog. The title of his new mushroom manual spells this out clearly. How to Forage for Mushrooms Without Dying. An absolute beginner's guide to identifying 29 wild edible mushrooms. Published October 5th by Story Publishing, the 256-page book is a colorful and accessible guide to a hobby with a barrier to entry that's often perceived as high. This perception, in fact, is why Hyman has taken me to a downtown Durham park near his house and not a more heavily wooded location. He says, I wanted to bring you here and go into the park to get away from this idea that the only way to forage is to get in the car and go off to some woods, because mushrooms are everywhere. This is true. Anyone who's ever had a damp square inch of front yard grass knows that mushrooms can sprout in the dark of night with astonishing speed. They also stitch the world together. Fungi are the largest source of living particles in the air and produce more than 50 megatons of spores, roughly equivalent to the weight of 500,000 blue whales, and 90% of plants are dependent on fungi for nutrients. Still, their dark fairy tale associations with dirt, rot, fleshy textures, and poison have lent them an intimidating air of mystery, despite their relative low risk. This fear, according to Hyman, is mycophobia. Mycophobia, a centuries-old carryover from English colonialism, which, as he writes in his book, created an attitude of disdain for potentially dangerous mushrooms and then spread to other English-speaking countries governed by Britain, including the United States, and along the way, Durham, North Carolina. How to Forage for Mushrooms Without Dying is one antidote to mycophobia. Hyman, who is also a designer, laid the pocket-sized book out with impressive visual appeal. After a few healthy introductions to mushroom parts and mushroom basics, he guides readers through 29 different edible types, sprinkling digestible essays throughout. While most foraging books rely on Latin terminology and overly esoteric language, Hyman's take on the genre is more intuitive. Each mushroom variety is paired with a checklist, the what, when, and where of mushroom types and field ID lists. Every item, he emphasizes, must be correct in order for readers to forage the mushroom. Hyman's research has paid off. The book has been picked up by national retailers ranging from Urban Outfitters to REI. It also found great timing. The pandemic saw an uptick in interest in fungi from home fermentation to foraging as people spent more time at home. People also began to look to foodways experts for guidance, like the Durham cultural preservationist Justin Robinson, whose Instagram handle is @countrygentlemancooks, who was recently featured in a New York Times article about black foragers. But although widespread interest in mushrooms has seen a recent uptick, Hyman's roots in the natural world go deep. He's a charismatic, down-to-earth talker, George Saunders of foraging, and since the late 80s has cobbled together a living through a roving interest in the natural world. This living has included accomplishments, slightly undermined by the friendly comic sans font they are outlined in on his website, like serving on the Durham City Council, getting arrested at Moral Monday protests, writing an erstwhile gardening column for Indy, and leading an effort to legalize backyard hens in Durham. Hyman's first connection with mushrooms, as he remembers it, was during his 20s in South Carolina, where he spotted an indigo milk cap mushroom, which, when broken apart, leaks chalky blue milk. He says, "I didn't know who would help me identify it. I didn't even know there were mushroom guidebooks, right? I was just like, wow, that color is amazing. I'm going to learn about mushrooms one day." Now at Duke Park, it grows dark. Hyman continues to point out the spots where mushrooms grow during rainier periods. As we walk up the street, he spots Hen of the Woods, a chunky brown mushroom that ruffles out at the base of a tree and kneels to investigate. It's a prized foraging find. "They can be kind of gray to brown and in between," he says, just as a neighboring screen door opens and a man steps out and yells over, "Hey, that's my mushroom!" The neighbor is joking, though, and he knows Hyman well. And with just two paragraphs left in this article, my clock is running out, and the mysterious ray guns from Zargon and his terror orchestra are beginning to be unholstered. And so I think it's about time for me to tell you that you can hear this entire broadcast again at the podcast section of the ncreadingservice.org, our website. And we hope you've enjoyed it and have a lovely Thanksgiving holiday and weekend. And we'll be back with the next issue in another week. John Feddersen for the North Carolina Reading Service, ncreadingservice.com, saying bye-bye.